Hello.
And we're back.
We are back. Back from a long journey.
Very long.
Very journey-ish. To the gateway to the west.
Indeed.
And then back again.
Well.
This is all very cool until...
Until the East Coast suffered a plane problem, and that caused us to be stuck in St. Louis for an extra night. And it was not in any way Anheuser-Busch's fault. It was mostly the travel company's fault.
Yeah, I mean, it was the travel company's fault that it sucked as much as it did.
Yeah.
Where we got the flight canceled things.
Let's explain what happened and then.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, then explain why it's not, why it's the travel company's fault. So we're scheduled to leave at 6:40 p.m. I think we had a flight at 6:40 p.m. out on Thursday. We had the tour had ended, all the stuff at Anheuser-Busch had ended. We were just in their beer garden having some beers.
People with early flights left before they could have, free time beers. People with medium flights like us could have one and would have to bolt.
Right.
And we're having our last beer before, we get in the car to go to the airport. And we get notification from United that the flight's been delayed. And it's been delayed such that we'll almost not make our connector in Chicago.
Yeah, right. It would be essentially impossible for us to make our connector in Chicago. So,
I've dealt with these corporate travel agencies before with NetApp, right? And they have an emergency number and you just don't sweat it. Even something, when you get a monkey wrench, you call them up and let them figure it out, right? So I'm like, well, this is cool, right? Because we're just going to hang out here at the beer garden until it's all worked out and do whatever. And I'm like, better hanging out here than at the airport.
Right, right.
Trying to figure stuff out. So we're hanging out to have a couple more beers. And the travel agency says, run to the airport. Get there and try to get on the flight that's leaving in 48 minutes. But they had not realized that the entire East Coast was all fucked up
at this
point. So there was like such a line at the ticket counter.
We finally got there. We got there with 20 minutes... About 15, 20 minutes to spare, which if the airport was empty, we would have been able to make it.
If the counter clerks at United weren't the most lackadaisical and slowest
people. There was a 2-hour line. I basically jumped right in front of the line and went up to the guy and said, look, we were on the canceled flight. Our travel agency said that we were on this flight that's leaving in 15 minutes. And the guy said, no, that flight is full. And the doors are closing anyway. And so we were then stranded at the airport. And so we then called up the travel agency. Got the travel agency, took about 30 minutes to call us back and said, okay, go to Southwest. It was right after that I called and they said, go to Southwest. So we had to go down a totally new terminal. And that took about 20 minutes to get to the new terminal. And it went to Southwest. And Southwest basically said, you're not in our system, and anyway, all our flights are canceled. So we were stuck at the airport. We got in touch with the travel agency. They set us up with a hotel, and they were planning on trying to find us flights out on Friday. So, okay, so we get the hotel, and we... We go downstairs to wait for the hotel bus, which is supposed to come every 20 minutes. Hotel bus, we're there for 20 minutes, hotel bus doesn't come. We call the hotel, say we're waiting. They say we're sending somebody over. 30 minutes pass, hotel bus hasn't come. Call the hotel says the guy was there and didn't see you, and we were sitting there for an hour. No one...
So I talked with a very nice guy the next morning because I had many hours to kill, and very nice guy. Turns out there at Terminal 1, there was like 35 people they had to pick up, and the van can only seat 7 people.
Mm-hmm.
So he was busy with Terminal 1, and I'm like, well, it would have been nice if he could have swung by. He's like, well, it takes like 11 minutes to swing by. It adds 11 minutes to the trip just to swing by. So... We got a free dinner out of it.
Yeah.
the weirdest thing was Greg starts talking to the Wyndham driver.
Yeah.
And this guy, God bless him, he's like, I'll after I drop off my guys back at the Wyndham, I'll run across, you know, just across the highway. I'll take you over and drop you guys off. And like,
yeah,
he was the only friendly travel person we experienced the whole day.
Right. And so, yeah, when we finally got into the hotel, I immediately said, I have a complaint. And they said, all right, well, we'll give you a... What I was trying to finagle out of it was I wanted to get free internet, but they already had free internet. they just immediately offered a free meal. So we were like, sure. So we got that.
And you had a shitty hamburger.
Yeah, I had a shitty hamburger.
Yeah, those kind of little like places where they don't really have a real kitchen.
Yeah.
Don't order hamburgers, you know.
I wanted a shitty hamburger. For some reason, there was something about...
You just want to be more pissed off?
I probably would... I looked at the Reuben and thought, but I wanted a hamburger. Really more... I kind of wanted fries more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And fries weren't on the menu, but they were there with the hamburger. So...
Right. I see. Yeah, the... So then they book Greg on like a super early flight,
right.
And they book me on a super late flight.
And I'm like, wait, can you switch that? Because Jeff wants to get home to his family, and you know, I don't have a family to get home to. I can hold out.
Plus, you'd prefer not to wake up at 4 a.m.
Would have preferred that, and they said no because they managed to get us flights very very booked day because there's a lot of people stuck in St. Louis,
mm-hmm.
And if they, in order to switch us, they'd have to take us out of the system and put us back in. And that means those seats would be up and then we might not get them back.
And most so likely would not get them back. So.
So we were just like, ugh, all right, fine. So yeah, I woke up at like 4:30. I only got to sleep at 10. So I managed to get like 6 hours.
Right. Well, then she's like, well, you guys could both go to the airport first thing in the morning.
And try to switch.
But then, even if we did switch, Greg would be at the airport 7 hours too early.
Right.
You know, so that just wasn't worth even trying, right? Because either we couldn't switch and I would be stuck at the airport for 7 hours, or we could switch and Greg would be stuck at the airport for 7 hours.
So as it worked out, I landed in Pittsburgh before Jeff got on his first plane out of St. Louis.
Yeah. I was sitting at the bar drinking some Goose Island IPA. Greg's like, I'm in Pittsburgh. I'm like... I don't know. For some reason, I thought you were like, I knew you had been in Chicago previously, but when I got the message, I was thinking, oh, you just landed in Chicago. And then I'm like, oh, wait, no, he's in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Wow, he's quite a bit ahead of me because I didn't get in until about 7:30 at night.
But you know, very easy flights, and it was, you know, it was pretty much standard procedure at the airport. It was just a mess that happened because some lightning strike in Baltimore hit a tower and that caused all types of shenanigans.
There was also, now I don't know if this had anything to do with their booking, you know, gate system, but United had a computer problem the same day where they were...
Hold on, Medichef has to adjust his...
We're multitasking here, and my computer wants to reboot... Come on, you can do it. No. You suck so bad. I can't get the focus on that window.
Here, let me give you a mouse.
I'm going to pause the recording.
That's what you get for using beta software, Greg. Right. Having trouble getting all the videos and stuff off of his phone.
They got it off my phone, fine, out of my computer.
Yeah, one wouldn't talk to my computer for some reason. Talking about the flight, right? Where did we leave off? We left off at... got in early, I got in late.
Yeah, we got
home. That's about it, so...
I
was talking about how... I don't know if this is the same computer system, but United was selling flights to Hawaii for like $13, like the same day. There was on the news. I don't think that would be the same system as the booketing reservation system, or you know, the gate system, right? But who knows? So either it was the lightning strike in Baltimore. However,
well, apparently no. Apparently there was a whole problem on the East Coast, and there were lots of flights that were canceled. Okay. That had to do with the Baltimore thing. But
the weird thing is, Chuck got home, and Chuck was flying right into BWI.
Yeah.
Because he didn't spend the night at the hotel. It was you, me, Greg, and I think there was someone else, but the guy I was talking to couldn't remember who it was. I'm like, Chuck Cook? He's like, no, it wasn't Chuck. So.
And Gerald got out because he got out before us.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, who knows about anybody else? Anyway. But the trip itself, let's not focus on the negative. The trip itself was pretty cool. This was, you know, the third of sort of the trilogy of trips involving Anheuser-Busch. The sort of the one that we were kind of sort of promised, but not really.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first one, I'll say this much. This is the first one that I felt like we belonged there.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how I mean, the first one, it just seemed like, whoa. You know, these are all beer writers.
Yeah.
And we're just these podcast guys. I mean, that was back in 2007, right? Yeah. So we were new. I mean, it was like, there's another video that failed.
I think it's failing all the ones that are long.
Yeah. Well, we'll screw with it later.
Yeah.
We're just trying to like capture the video off the phone, like we said, but it's not happening there either. So anyway, I can't remember 2008. I think 2008 kind of felt in a little bit, just because we'd done it before. Maybe yeah. We felt a little more fitting in. But, I mean, this time...
I still felt a little kind of shaky and not knowing what kind of questions to ask. I didn't understand beer as much at the time.
Yeah, I mean, but I feel this time, you know, really, we're just doing our thing.
Yeah.
Not letting anyone else influence us, really.
I mean, we were
except for in the tasting panel, where I clammed up.
Well, you clammed up. I didn't. I was kind of on fire.
You were throwing things out there. Some good, some the thing. So people who listen to our show know we throw out some oddball things, and maybe if it's even just a touch or a nuance of it, right? You'll throw it out there. Yeah. And you were, you know, some of the things you're throwing out were spot on. You could taste them, but you were starting to throw out some nuanced things, and nobody in the room was used to,
yeah,
that kind of nuance and just strange vocabulary. That's another thing. These guys that do the tasting panels, this would be good to talk about, you know, in the wrap up. But they taste together day in and day out, so they have a certain vocabulary that's common amongst them. You came in with our vocabulary.
Well, not only that, it was more expansive than their vocabulary. I mean, it was like they would say something along the lines of floral.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd go into what kind of flower, you know, if it was sort of rose-ish or if it was more, mm-hmm. you know, what kind of fruit it was coming out as. And I would go into the more specifics of the flavor. I mean, like at one point they called out, you know, peanut. And I was like, no, that's more pistachio. It was... Mm-hmm. I was really just trying to, you know, jump into what was actually coming out.
Right, right.
So
you got a gig out of it, a potential gig.
Yeah, I got a potential gig out of it.
John Hull from All About Beer is like really liked what Greg was coming up with, so you might see him in the back of the magazine coming up here.
It's possible. He said he thought I was spot on with all my stuff, and I was like, well. Thanks. You know, just have experience doing it. So, and so he said, "Yeah, you know, look at the back and send me an email."
Cool.
So, yeah. So that would be cool. I know that it was very interesting. I think that I learned a great deal about yeast there that I wasn't expecting to learn. Not necessarily the biology of yeast, because that wasn't really covered very extensively. Mm-hmm. However, what I think the most interesting thing, and Gerald talked about this when we were talking during the lunch, was that there was a point where we tasted the wort with different yeast, the same wort with three different lager yeasts and three different ale yeasts, mm-hmm. and you could really tell what the yeast was doing. And it brought a whole new sort of appreciation and understanding when I was at that lager table,
mm-hmm. right.
That when we went to the lager tasting eventually, that what I was smelling was not malt. The stuff that, you know, normally associated with malt was not malt. Budweiser almost has no malt flavor whatsoever. That's all esters from the yeast.
Right. It was crazy. I mean, yeah, I got a whole different understanding. A lot of this is going to be recapped in the the Budweiser show that we put up.
Right.
We're going to try to do something pretty produced on that one. We're not sure exactly what it's going to come of it yet, but we're going to try to do something a little bit more involved than our normal type of show or a normal type of review on a recap on something. But yeah, Budweiser is chock full of estery compounds.
Mm-hmm.
It's not nearly the clean, pilsnery beer I thought it was.
Yeah, it's really interesting when you finally, like, because we tasted, you know, Budweiser and then Busch and then Stella, and finally at Stella you were able to taste some malt.
Uh-huh.
Before then, you had not. There was almost no malt coming through whatsoever.
It was. It was actually the in the
Labatt Blue.
Labatt Blue, yeah. And then Beck's at the end. So those are the four beers we got to taste. We got to taste Budweiser, then Labatt. It would have been nice if I'm blind on. I would have preferred to be blind on that than seeing what they were.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was Budweiser, Labatt Blue, Stella, well, then Beck's.
I don't know. I mean, we would prefer if we were just trying to do a tasting judge thing, but that wasn't the point of their exercise. The point of their exercise was to explain how they compare the various different Budweisers from around the country and the world,
yeah,
and see how well they fit up to a certain standard.
Yeah.
So what we normally do is not what they normally do.
Right.
So that's another reason why some of my things that I were calling out were a little bit odd to them, because they were like, well, does it match the profile? I'm like, well, I don't know, because I don't taste a lot of Budweiser, but here's what I'm tasting in this beer.
Right. Well, in the tasting cellar, when you pulled out the peanut or whatever, like in the bright tanks, we're drinking.
Oh,
the
yeah,
bright tanks.
Peanut butter.
You're talking to the brewer. He's like, I hope not. He's like, about ready to freak out that, you know, this beer's already going production, and you know, just your vocabulary for peanut butter is not.
Yeah. I think he was.
It's like when I call Vienna Lager has a wonderful mushroom flavor, and the guy thinks I just smacked his baby. Yeah, that kind of thing happened, you know.
Yeah, we tasted a Budweiser right off the
bright tank.
The bright tank. So right after it's been sitting for, you know, 21 days, right before it's ready to be bottled.
Yeah, yeah. It was after it was carbonated in prior to bottling. So basically.
So. As fresh as you can get it. I mean, and not something apparently that's, you know, a lot of the stuff we did on the tour was pretty VIP stuff that nobody gets a chance to see. That was something that apparently other tours.
If you do the Brewmaster's tour and pay like the $25, you get the drink out of the bright tank.
So, but still, I mean, it was interesting. It was, it tasted a little bit sulfury at that point, but that was okay. I mean, it was on a style.
Mm-hmm.
The peanut butter was a weird ester I was getting. It was interesting. It was something like an organic peanut butter, like a fresh, fresh ground peanut butter, or maybe even almond butter.
Okay.
But it was really cold too. It was hard.
It was like 35.
It was 35 degrees in the room while we were tasting, and the stuff coming out of there was very cold.
However, that room didn't seem as cold as it was downstairs. That first place we were in.
Maybe, heat rises, you know.
Yeah, maybe that's it. I'm surprised they don't jacket those tanks. I'm surprised that they chill the whole room like that. You figure it'd be cheaper to jacket the tanks, but guess not.
Well, I mean, I don't know what the efficiency would be versus, you know, buying a whole jacket and then and having to repair a jacket constantly versus just chilling the whole place. And
yeah, well, it's also constant temperature, like fermentation. They use the jacket to control each vessel's specific temperature, right? Where in the bright room, you know, you just keep everything the same temperature. There's no calculate, you know, corrections here or there. There's nothing generating heat that you have to counter and stuff like that. So
it felt a little it was. I was taken aback a little by the enormity of it all. It's a incredibly impressive and huge operation that they have. A great deal of automation, immense amount of machinery, and immense amount of manpower going into making this stuff. It caught me almost off guard as just how big the production was. So I was pretty amazed by that. What I came out with was,
how do you like those 5,600 barrel fermenters?
Yeah, jeez.
You look down and down and down. It's like six floors of Furman, or it's insane.
We've talked before, like when we went to the other two things about, is Anheuser-Busch capable of making good beer? Now, the answer to that question is yes. Anheuser-Busch is capable of making good beer. Are they capable of selling it? The answer to that question is no. And this really has to do with the problem that the genie is sort of out of the bottle and it can't come back in again. They got too big. The market that they're looking at just aren't the same as a craft market. So they don't really, you know, they can't handle a small production. Put in too much problems into their large manufacturing system.
Well, that'd be a good question to ask them, right? Is what is the smallest amount of sales you could have and still consider a successful line brand of beer, you know? Just screensaver.
Okay.
But, you know, like, you know, if it has to be 100 million barrels or it's not successful, you know, I think that's the problem, right?
Yeah, I mean, we got to go to their pilot brewery and look at all the stuff they're doing, and the pretzel brew was a very interesting brew. I'm not sure if I would call it great, but I would say it's very interesting and unique. And
a lot of people are telling him it was
cool
great.
Try.
It smelled neat. I didn't like the flavor all that much, but
what I got more was that the pilot brewery, which is sort of right in the middle of the whole complex, is not so much. I mean, they do some experimental stuff, but it's also really more of a training ground. It's more of a school for their brewmasters,
right.
And you know, so they let them experiment with certain styles, but they also are like, you know, try to make Bud as close as possible as we do in the big things, and try to make Bud Light, et cetera, et cetera. So you know, it's sort of like Budweiser University.
Yeah,
and that's fine. I mean, it's a kind of an apprenticeship in a large scale thing. And then people can go on to do other things. We had an argument on the way to the airport about whether the craft beer aesthetic, you know, is better to come from people who love beer and then go into it, or if that matters, that people sort of learn beer and then come out of Budweiser. Does that matter for a craft brewer?
Right. I mean, I was just trying to figure out where this disconnect is, where they can make beer but they can't sell it, right? Or they can make a beer. They can make a good beer, but they can't make good beer. Right. You know, and that's vague. I left it vague so, you know, the listener can kind of figure out what I mean by that, right? Mm-hmm. I was proposing to Greg, I wonder if it has to do with how these brewmasters are brought up in the system, because it's very not what I would expect and what I think many of the listeners would expect, where we're familiar with all these guys who are working at craft breweries, who start there because of the passion for beer first, and then the skills come second. Mm-hmm. It is still stunning to me the number of people who are brewmasters at Anheuser-Busch who started working at Anheuser-Busch in a non-brewing capacity and got into the brewing training track. And if almost all of their beer experience comes from that training track, you can see how it could be this very insular and self-replicating system.
Well, I can see where that idea comes from, but you know, you have to think that the craft brewer is going to be a more exceptional, more sort of artisan type thing. So it's like the idea that comes to mind is you can teach anyone in culinary school how to make bread. But the people who then go on to become artisanal bakers are the people who find they really love making bread and they love doing it. So you can teach anyone to brew beer. And that's what they're doing in Anheuser-Busch. They're teaching people how to brew beer. But absolutely, out of that,
they're not, well, I mean, that's not even, they're doing more than that. I mean, they're teaching people to develop their palate. They're teaching people to know the ins and outs of beer.
But out of that, you're going to find, if not everybody, not everybody they train is going to become a craft brew.
Was it Rebecca? Is she the?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
Not everybody they train is going to become a craft brew master, but there are going people they train who are going to become craft brewmasters. And it's the same sort of thing. They're doing large-scale training. They're doing large-scale, basically vocational training. And then people, if they really like what they're doing and they want to jump out, they will. Mm-hmm. People like Florian.
It also seems like there's probably a set of golden handcuffs.
Yes.
You know, because not too many people, other than when the whole InBev acquisition happened, you don't hear about too many people jumping ship to start craft breweries.
Although we did hear about people jumping ship from other breweries, other major breweries, to jump to Anheuser-Busch because the culture was better at Anheuser-Busch. We don't have anything for those other major breweries to say anything about, so to bring it up would be not necessarily good reporting. But pre-show, it's fine.
Rebecca, I mean, she knew her stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and she, 8 years ago, she didn't know anything about beer. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, she knows more than I do, right? Her palate is probably better than mine. Maybe not as diverse and, you know, as wide, but for the things that she has experience with, it's definitely better. And she has a pretty good experience with a fairly wide amount of stuff. She's talking about how, you know, in this training of brewmasters, they have basically the equivalent of a senior project, right? Mm-hmm. And she said the guys are working on now, she just go brew a wheat wine, you know? And it's like, oh, you wouldn't expect Anheuser-Busch to be telling these guys go figure out a wheat wine. But they're, you know, so that sounds like promising. And then Greg asked the question, you know, what's the hoppiest beer that you guys have made here? You know, and you can just use an IBUs as kind of a way to measure that. And she's like, oh, about 80. And they do 2 brews a day, 7 days a week, five or seven days a week. They've been doing it for years and years and years, and they've never made anything hoppier or bigger than that. It seems like, really? I mean, that makes you think they're not pushing the boundaries.
Right.
But then you see things like in the fermentation cellar, there's 2 fermenters that like where they're playing with Orval yeast.
Yeah.
So it's like this whole dichotomy of not, or maybe like just touching the boundaries, but not pushing them or something. I don't know. It's weird.
It was hard to get. It's unfortunate because we didn't get maybe as much time to really delve into it as we would have wanted, I think. And that's just, you know, it's a function of the fact that we were there for a short period of time, and you know, they were in the middle of doing their stuff, and you know, they have to work too, so they can't take all the time out to answer all of our questions.
A lot of other beer writers.
But you know, they gave us a pretty good overview of their operations. They gave us a good overview of the yeast lab and a real learning experience in terms of what yeast is doing. Not just their beers, but really to all beers.
Wait till you get to see the show. I don't want to spoil the whole thing, but just the yeast culture facility, the scale of the thing is stunning.
Yeah.
You won't believe how big their largest propagation tank is. It's a fermenter, but they use it the goal of this tank is to make more yeast, not to make beer. It does make beer, but the goal is to make yeast. And I'm not going to tell you how many barrels it is. You're going to have to tune in, but if you guess the number, you're off. You're way off. It's much, much bigger.
We had extra time. We got to see the Clydesdales. That was interesting, little sort of offshoot. Mm-hmm.
We had some time. We went up on the roof of the one brewery. The building that houses the Pilot Brewery, and it's a 9-story building. And you could kind of, it was in the center of the campus. You could look all around. The amount of piping,
probably hundreds of miles. I mean, it seemed that way.
I'm sure it was hundreds of miles. It might even be 1,000 miles. The amount of piping just was visible, snaking everywhere, over here, there, up and down. It was boggling.
Yeah, and so it was kind of a wonderful, absurd, and just, you know, example of pure excess on a balance that we hadn't really been exposed to. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I mean, clearly there's a market for what they do. Clearly they're doing good stuff. the absurdity came in because it was just so big. It was just on an entirely different level than, you know, I mean, he just went to Urban Chestnut, Florian Kuplin's mm-hmm. brewery. You know, the small brewery that is you know, has a brew house, and they have, what, 30-gallon fermenters, I think, or something like that.
Barrel.
30-barrel fermenters, and they have about 8 of them, and they're doing some really cool stuff. And we've seen, like, the Flying Dog Brewery, and we've seen even, you know, we've seen New Belgium, and they're pretty big. Mm-hmm. Nice big regional one. This is on a not entirely different level.
It's bonkers.
It's just bonkers. And so, you know, we're very thankful to be able to be on this experience. As a craft beer enthusiast, there were things that we could learn from that, but there was not a lot of pure stuff that was going to appeal to us. And they kind of knew that. They gave us some things that were, I mean, you know, they had a Saison they're working on, but they're not going to throw any Brett in there, right? They're not going to throw anything, you know, it was close to a Saison. It wasn't quite what I would expect out of a pure Saison, but it was close.
Yeah, they could have, well, I don't know, yeah. I don't know what I want to go, how far I want to go, but, you know, they're talking about, like, all these great things they do in the Pilot Brewery, and we tasted what? 4 Pilot Brews?
Something like that. I mean, 3 at the dinner, or 4 at the dinner, because they had the Apricot Saison that we also tried a little bit of.
But those weren't Pilot Brews. I mean, it was Budweiser, it was...
No, the first dinner. There was the... there was the Bourbon Lager, there was the Bach, and there was the Pacific Northwest Lager.
Oh, those ones. Okay, and yeah. I forgot about the reception cut. Yeah, okay.
And then we tried their pretzel beer and their regular Saison. And I think that was it in terms of Pilot or test mm-hmm. beers. But they weren't really trying to impress upon us their craft stuff. I think they tried to do that in the past, and it didn't work for them.
Did they? When? I mean...
Well, like when, you know, when they were...
They had more opportunity now than... I mean... There was bottles of stuff sitting everywhere. They had a year's worth of Pilot Brewery stuff in the cooler.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, they could have opened it up. And it's not like most of the writers weren't craft writers. Most of them were craft writers. Right. Yeah, so they definitely could have... done the yeast, and then, hey, here's all our Pilot stuff.
Yeah.
And it really didn't go that direction.
There was, like you said, golden handcuffs. There was a little, mm-hmm. there was definitely a sort of control aspect that it was, you know, we were getting a VIP tour, but it was also very much, we were seeing what they wanted us to see. So... That's fine. Mm-hmm. They do their thing, and their thing, you know, plays a role. You know, and without them, the craft beer industry wouldn't be around anyway. And so that's something to take mm-hmm. note of.
Yeah. So waiting to get a bunch of questions answered from Tony.
Right.
You saw the email I sent this morning.
Right.
You know, just on reflection, I had a whole bunch of questions I had failed to ask or. Wanted some clarification to make sure I got the details right. And we're going to work those into this show. You know, Greg mentioned, you know, maybe we're going to try to do something that's a little Radio Lab like.
Right.
But it's not going to be nearly as good as a bad Radio Lab.
I don't want to, you know, I don't want to break our aesthetic too much. I don't want it to, mm-hmm. you know, be a super overproduced thing. But what I do want to do is I'm going to try to transcribe all the stuff that we have down. Get that into a Google Doc. That way we can then highlight the parts that we want to mm-hmm. express. Then I can get the time codes for that, and we can sort of cut that up. Then put in parts where we'll talk in between the stuff that mm-hmm. they say.
Right.
And so that will be a process that we can do. Then so we'll try to form an interesting narrative.
Right.
And have the places where mm-hmm. they talk and you know basically go through the tour. then what we can do is, you know, make the video presentation, make the figure out how we want to whether we want to integrate the video in with it or
it depends on how well the video fits and can fill out and can complement the narrative, right? Maybe I got enough B-roll. Maybe I don't have nearly enough. And right, if the latter is the case, then there's going to be the audio show, and then kind of a video,
presentation,
a short of it, you know, type thing. But if I have enough video footage to go with the narrative, then it's going to be a video presentation, the whole thing. So
that's the idea. So yeah, so it's going to be like talking interspersed with clips from people, and then us talking, that sort of conversational mm-hmm. type thing. So that's the idea behind it, and I'm going to start working on
lots of recording in noisy rooms. Hopefully,
yes.
That came out.
You know, I listened to some of the stuff that we got, and some of it's pretty noisy, but you can hear. And the stuff that you can't hear, well, we can say
right.
what people said
right.
or do stuff like that. So there, mm-hmm. there's going to be loud changes in noise throughout the program. So how we can normalize it, I guess.
Yeah.
So that's the idea for how we're going to do the show. And I was running by Jeff certain titles and things, you know.
I think you're being too cute with all the ones you've suggested so far.
Right. Although I want something that expresses both the, you know, how interesting it was, how huge it was, how, like I say, absurd it was, and also how it still wasn't like a craft beer event. So
let's forget about the title until it's done.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Just forget about the title until it's done. We'll see what we come up with, and we'll do a title that fits that.
That seems fair.
Because you're trying to come up with this cutesy title, and the title would, at that point, the title was going to influence
show. Well, because the title to me was sort of, it was, I mean, I wouldn't say that it was the final title. It was the work in progress, because I was just thinking about
You don't know how the footage is going to fit together.
No, I don't.
That's why if you really want a title similar to the ones you've suggested, it's going to influence how you put the show together.
Yeah.
Let the show come together. Okay. Then we'll come up with a title.
That's a reasonable reasonable idea. I will acquiesce to that very reasonable suggestion. So yeah, so we have a lot of a great deal of pictures. We have a great deal of video.
Yep.
And we have a lot of audio, great deal of audio, and we're going to try to make something really cool as both, you know, sort of thank you to everybody who listens, everybody who does any donations, and Anheuser-Busch for sending us on this thing in the first place.
Yeah, my main goal is just to tell a story.
Yeah.
Not to create a PR piece for Anheuser-Busch.
Right.
Right. I want that narrative. I want to tell the story. Be it whether it's primarily yeast propagation, yeast production. I'm not so sure it's going to be a story of Greg and Jeff go to St. Louis. You know, I think there might even be more things. I mean, maybe it works out where the yeast part is one thing, the giant brewery part is another thing, and the resource pilot brewery is a third thing.
Right.
So I really don't want to do Jeff and Greg go to St. Louis. That's not the show. That's not what I want to come of it. So,
okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, we'll see what we get out of the footage we have.
Right.
And we'll keep you posted. I mean, I wouldn't expect this for another couple of weeks at least, because we're gonna have to,
especially if the ambitions we have are achieved, it's gonna be a lot of work.
Yeah. But, you know, with me doing stuff like, transcoding and getting time codes, it should help the editing at least, and hopefully we'll be able to get some.
Yeah, maybe, I mean, do it iteratively. Start with an outline, you know, and And then once you have the outline,
yeah,
maybe you focus the plan.
First I'll get the transcripts, then we'll highlight.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by transcripts, because I mean getting like the word for word transcription of it doesn't really make sense, right? Get an outline of all the content that we got, right? And then let's figure out which pieces need focused on to spend more time on to transcribe, right? Because if you actually try to transcribe 8 hours of tour, it's going to be insane.
Okay, all right. I'll get together what the audio files are and what's discussed in the audio files. Then we can figure out where to go from there. Like, there's one that's an hour long. It's just mm-hmm. the tasting thing we did, and obviously we don't want to do a whole transcription.
Right? Yeah, yeah. It takes sections out of there. But yeah, I mean, I would say, yeah, definitely tie it to the file. You know, but you know, what did we do first? We did.
We could probably skip the dinner. I don't think the dinner is that important, but
there. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you're probably right, but we might have caught some good conversation. I'm not sure if we did or not, but might have caught some stuff here and there. But, you know, basically, just start with an outline. Just do an outline of all the content. And then, you know, if you think parts are worth, you know, are a sure thing that we really want to get into the paragraph by paragraph, you know, I wouldn't even go transcription on the second pass, right? I would just kind of dial in even more, you know, and say from this time slot to this time slot, we're talking about this specific thing. And from this time slot to this time slot, this specific thing. And then I think that will, in the long run, would save you time. I mean, unless you're really good at listening to audio and transcribing it, but that just sounds...
I wanted to try it at least to see how well I could do, because there could be stretches where there's long... I mean, what's going to happen? Is there a stretch where there's long stuff of stuff that isn't of interest, but there's mm-hmm. going to be a sentence or two that is of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And having the transcript helps you capture that sentence.
Right. Well, if you want to. I was just suggesting a way that might be more fruitful.
Let me start with the transcript, and if I find it just to be a slog and to be impenetrable, then I'll go your route.
You'll have to figure out a couple things. You're going to have to figure out a good app to play this back where you can slow it down quickly and go back to normal speed, and then also jump back 10 seconds or something like mm-hmm. that, right? You'll have to find two quick ways to do that, because you'll be doing that a lot.
What I could probably do is encode them onto my iPod as
well. They are MP3s already, right?
And put them in a podcast app and just turn mm-hmm. it down to slow and just type away.
Have you ever tried listening to it at half speed?
It's a little bit
yeah. It's very motorboaty. They repeat syllables again and again. So, but the, you know, the back 15 seconds would be like that kind of button would be very helpful. 15 seconds. Be nice if you could do like a 5 second though. I think that'd probably be more useful than a 15. See what VLC has. VLC probably has some jumps and stuff.
Yeah, it probably does.
And you might even be able to change the playback speed in VLC too.
Oh, you can, yes.
So that's probably a better thing than the podcast app.
All right, good point. So yeah, that's what we're gonna do, and we hope you enjoy it when it comes out. And if you have any suggestions or questions or would like to see stuff, I Instagrammed a bunch of photos from.
Scream sell out to us as loud as you can. You know, whatever you want.
As I said, you know, it's hard to be a sellout when you're not really getting paid.
That's exactly when you sell out.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess that is true. That is when you sell out. But no, I mean, we don't want, where you're not planning to aggrandize in Azerbaijan.
Like I said, I don't want this to be a pure PR piece, yeah. Right? I want it to be about the yeast, the science, the fact, you know, just the interesting part about how they do it. So, all right, time to drink some beers.
Let's do it.